This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Violence is everywhere in nature, but it doesn't always involve teeth and claws. That's one reason you may be blissfully unaware of the war going on beneath the waves of the Caribbean Sea. It's a slow-moving battle that's fought largely with chemical weapons, and wins and losses are often tallied in just millimeters. That's the other thing that can make it hard to see. You're probably thinking, what is she talking about, right? Well, the answer is corals and sponges. These two staples of tropical reefs have been duking it out for thousands, if not millions, of years, locked in competition for space and limited resources. Given that we call them coral reefs, not sponge reefs, I think it's fair to say that corals have been the historical winners. But over the past few decades, human activities have dramatically shifted the balance of power. Overfishing, nutrient pollution, sediment runoff from coastal development, and of course, climate change have all pushed corals to the breaking point, and sponges have exploited their weakness. So much so that sponges, not corals, are now the primary habitat-forming organisms on most Caribbean reefs. Later this hour, you'll hear from one scientist trying to understand precisely how our greenhouse gas emissions wreak such havoc on corals, and another hoping to shed light on how sponges affect the ecosystem around them. But first, if you'll indulge me, I want to tell you a bit of a story. This past summer, I traveled to the Florida Keys with a team of researchers from Northeastern University. For me, it was the trip of a lifetime, a chance to visit the world's only underwater lab. And that's something I'd wanted to do since I was a 12-year-old aspiring marine biologist. My dive to Aquarius, that's the underwater habitat and lab, it was my first ocean dive in 8 years, and only the second time I'd scuba dived in the Caribbean. Most of my reef diving has been in the Pacific, which is known for having more abundant and diverse corals. So at first, I wondered if what seemed to my eyes to be a lack of corals was just my own bias, my lack of experience talking. But on a later dive, my buddy, who was a multi-decade veteran of Caribbean marine biology, he set a goal for us: to find as much live coral as we could. It should have been a list too long to remember, but it wasn't. And Stephen was particularly excited about one small stand of branching corals that looked like 4-inch-tall deer antlers. By small, I mean less than a foot in diameter. And that's when I knew things were bad. So on my last night in Florida, I pulled aside one of the lead scientists from Northeastern University.
I'm Mark Patterson, and I'm professor of marine and environment. Excuse me, marine and environment.
How about we start over?
I'm Woody Woodpecker. I'm going through puberty. My voice is cracking because I've been in the water too much. I'm Mark Patterson, and I'm professor of marine and environmental sciences at Northeastern University at the Marine Science Center out at Nahant, Massachusetts.
As you may have gathered, Mark Patterson has a sense of humor. In fact, he's constantly joking. He plays pranks on students and colleagues, and for the few days I was around, he often had an almost goofy grin on his face. So I had to ask, doesn't the state of the reefs get to him?
It's depressing. You know, I got interested in marine science and coral reefs because I got to go on an Earthwatch expedition when I was a rising senior in high school, and I got to see the Bahamas back summer of 1974. And it's like the old National Geographic pictures with just luxuriant stands of all manner of coral. And I went all throughout the islands with Richard Cheshire, and we did surveys for the Bahamian government of the reef cover and the biodiversity. And the Bahamian reefs were in wonderful shape back then. And now there are some Bahamian reefs that are in really, really good shape. Thankfully, there are hope spots there. But the Bahamas and Florida and many other places in the Caribbean have been on a long, slow slide. It's like watching a train crash in slow motion. And when you look at the landscape, it's like looking at an overgrown, mossy city, like something out of one of these apocalyptic movies you see in the theater, where you see the corals that used to be there, and in your mind's eye, you just blur your eyes and imagine them all alive, and then you open your eyes and see they're all covered in algae and that they're dead. It's depressing for someone that knows what the baseline was decades ago, and now it's not.
Patterson has been studying Caribbean reefs his entire career, so he knows what he's looking at. But he says younger divers don't even know what they're missing, in part because it's easy to be fooled by the beauty that is still there, just like I was.
There's still lots of life there. I mean, nature abhors a vacuum, so if you don't have coral, you will have lots of algae, and you may still have lots of fish. It won't be the same fish community that was there when the corals were there. And there's lots of really cool invertebrates, animals without backbones, and it's still a stunningly beautiful underwater world in its own way. But, the younger set doesn't know, unless they look in a old magazine article or picture books, what it used to look like.
Patterson doesn't begrudge the sponges their success. In fact, he seems to rather admire their tenacity.
I mean, they are survivors. The phylum has been on the planet for 500 million years, which is pretty astonishing.
And they're important components of all coral reefs, filtering, by some estimates, 50,000 times their volume in water every day. Large sponges also provide hiding places for fish and other animals in need of relief from predators. But when it comes to actually building reefs, sponges can't hope to compete with corals.
You know, other than human beings, they're the only structures made by living things on Earth that you can see from outer space, which is pretty amazing.
Patterson hasn't given up hope on Caribbean coral reefs. He says there are spots of hope dotted throughout the Caribbean, and he sees great potential in the power of marine protected areas. But he's cautious in his optimism in the face of global threats to coral reefs.
If I were to start a career over right now, I would probably go into chemistry and really try and figure out ways of extracting CO2 from the atmosphere and figuring out alternative energy. And that's where I would put my energy, because I realize that ultimately that's going to be, we have to do a course correction fast.
That's Mark Patterson of Northeastern University. I spoke to him when I visited the Aquarius Underwater Lab off the Florida Keys last summer. And joining me now, Anne Cohen of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She's associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Geology and Geophysics and co-author of a new study that helps explain how climate change and pollution help competitors like sponges get the upper hand on corals. Anne Cohen, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much, Heather. It's great to be here.
A lot of your work takes place in the Pacific, and so I wonder if the kinds of apocalyptic scenarios we're hearing, you know, from Mark Patterson and seeing in the Caribbean are a global phenomenon, or if the Caribbean is really worse off than the rest of the world in some way.
I think it's safe to say that the Caribbean is probably, at this point, worse off than the reefs that we're studying in the Pacific. But the coral reef decline that we're seeing and measuring and have been observing for the last several decades, since about the mid-1970s, that is a global phenomenon. I can put some numbers on that for you if you like.
Absolutely.
So, for example, in the Caribbean, since about 1980, the many, many reefs have lost up to 80% of their living coral cover. Now, as Mark was explaining, the sponges are living creatures on the reef, and they are still fish. But in order to maintain a reef, a living, functional reef ecosystem, you need the organisms that build the reef. And those are the corals, primarily, and the coral and algae. And what we're seeing across the Caribbean and now into the Pacific is a significant decline in the numbers of live corals and live coral and algae. That means that the organisms that are building and producing the reef are dying at a great rate. In some areas that we're working, for example, in Puerto Rico, only 5% of what was originally there still exists, is still live. So you've got the reef structure. You can think of it like an apartment building, a high-end apartment that was once bustling and full of furniture and being maintained and painted and kept up. Now that apartment building is derelict. The building is still there. The structure is still there. but the occupants have long left, and now it's falling apart. That is what is happening to our coral reefs.
There are a number of factors that contribute to this. I mean, fishing, in some cases in the world, fishing actually involves physically destroying reefs. Even when that's not the case, taking out the fish can that actually keep algae from taking over the reef can then impact the corals. We've got pollution in the form of sediment runoff and nutrients, other chemicals, and then there's climate change. If you had to try to rank those, is it possible to rank those different impacts? Does climate change stand out as a greater threat, or is it just part of this whole situation facing coral reefs?
That's a really good question. And I would say, prior to about 1975, the direct human impacts, like humans touching reefs, that would include overfishing, dynamiting, putting sewage onto reefs, coastal development that increases sediment runoff. Those were the activities that were predominantly to blame for the coral reef decline, and specifically for the decline in live coral cover. But as the ocean started warming, and this was post-1975, big warming events started happening, what we were seeing are massive, large-scale coral bleaching. And what that means is that the corals are losing, when corals bleach, they lose the organisms inside of them that provide them with food. And what happens is the corals then starve to death. Some corals can recover, but what these high temperature events do is to cause large-scale mortality across vast areas of reef. And so I would say at this point, ocean warming coupled with warm events such as those driven by El Nino are probably the greatest threat to the survival of coral reefs today. We're also seeing the acidification of the ocean. That means the ocean pH is declining. And this is going to start becoming a huge problem in the next few decades.
The warming that you're talking about, I mean, it's estimated that something like 80, perhaps even more than 90% of the excess heat that's trapped by greenhouse gas emissions goes into the ocean. And even if we went cold turkey on greenhouse gas emissions today, we would still see decades, if not centuries, of warming to come. Are we essentially at the point where we're just waiting for the end of corals? Is there any way for them to adapt to and keep up with this warming that at this point is irreversible, at least on the scale of decades to centuries?
That's a good point. So with each, we have lost a significant amount of coral already. An estimated 20% of coral reef has been lost globally, has been lost forever due to global warming or due to ocean warming.
20% already?
Already. That is what is estimated. But during each warming event that causes bleaching, that leads to mass mortality, there are some corals and some coral reef communities or communities of corals that don't bleach. So there are signs that some communities or species have higher thresholds for temperature than others. And we look to those species that are hanging on, or those communities that are hanging on, to be the ones who can potentially adapt, given the opportunities, to a slow increase in ocean temperature.
That's Anne Cohen of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We're talking about the varied threats, and in particular, the impacts of climate change on our coral reefs across the globe. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Anne Cohen, associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, about her research on the various ways that greenhouse gas emissions affect coral reefs and interact with other human impacts to threaten coral reefs everywhere. Now, Anne, before the break, you had mentioned that not only is the ocean temperature rising, but then there's this other phenomenon that's been called by some the evil twin of climate change, ocean acidification, that carbon dioxide going into the ocean is actually fundamentally changing the chemistry of the ocean. I mean, that to me is just a stunning concept, that we could change the chemistry of the entire ocean. How does carbon dioxide, when it gets into the ocean, how does it change the pH, and what is the ramifications of that for organisms like corals?
So humans are now, at this point, emitting approximately 9 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year. That's a stunning amount. And about 26% of that is actually taken up by the ocean. Now, that might seem like it's not a big deal, carbon dioxide being taken up by the ocean. But the carbon dioxide doesn't just sit there. It actually interacts with the water molecules to form an acid called carbonic acid. And that formation of the carbonic acid causes the buildup of hydrogen ions or protons in the water. That buildup of protons causes the pH of the ocean to decline.
I mean, we're literally producing enough of this carbonic acid to change the pH to make the ocean more acidic on the whole.
Yes. That is what is happening. The models, the calculations predict that this will happen. And our measurements out in the oceans are showing that the pH has been declining at least for the past 30 years.
On one level, that is an incredibly simple, this is chemistry. You put carbon dioxide in water, it creates carbonic acid. We can calculate how much and that it's going to change the pH. But on another level, does that not boggle your mind that we are capable of changing the chemistry of the entire ocean?
Well, if you think about how many people there are and how much CO2 we're emitting, it actually makes quite a lot of sense that we could do this.
And what does that then mean for corals? If the pH of the ocean is dropping, how does that affect their ability to live and grow?
So a coral reef is actually made of calcium carbonate. And that calcium carbonate is made by organisms. It's made by the corals, and it's made by coral and algae. And these are plants that actually produce calcium carbonate. Now, obviously, the corals are making calcium carbonate so that they can build a skeleton and they can grow. It's their house. They seek refuge in that skeleton. They use it to reach upward towards the sunlight. But ultimately, once that coral dies and it's broken down, that calcium carbonate becomes incorporated into the reef structure. And that's what builds the reef. That is the source of material, the bricks and mortar that build the reef structure. Now, calcium carbonate, obviously, is made out of calcium and carbonate ions in seawater. Now, when the pH of seawater decreases, as it is under ocean acidification, the carbonate ion concentration decreases as well. There's not much carbonate ion in seawater to start with. Only about 10% of all the carbon in seawater is in the form of carbonate ion. And all these calcifying organisms, the corals and the coral and algae that are built up producing calcium carbonate to build the reef, they are all taking this carbonate ion, this 10% that's there. They're all competing for it. Now, that little that's there is now declining. So the corals and the coral and algae and the organisms that are building the reef actually have fewer carbonate ions with which to build their skeletons. And skeletal growth rates and calcium carbonate production rates are declining.
Why is it important for these reefs to keep growing? Why couldn't the coral organisms simply live on the skeleton that's already there and the reef structure that's already there?
Well, that's a really good question, Heather, because actually, what's happening on a reef every single day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is that corals and other calcifiers are producing the calcium carbonate that the reef needs, And there's a myriad of other organisms, including those sponges that you and Mark were talking about earlier, that are eroding and breaking down and dissolving that calcium carbonate. So the reef is the reef structure is a very dynamic, in a very dynamic process of being built up and being torn down. And in a healthy reef, the balance between the production and the removal of calcium carbonate is very tight. So the production rates are only slightly higher than the removal rates in a healthy reef system. And that's how reefs can stay where they are, exposed to the sunlight, so that the corals and coral algae can live.
And why do the corals need to be exposed to sunlight if they're animals?
That's also a really good question. So corals are not just animals. In fact, they are living in a close relationship with little single-celled algae, plants. And those algae actually live inside the coral cells. And because they're plants, they're photosynthesizing and they're producing food. And that food is transferred from the algae to the coral. The coral actually gets food from its algal symbionts that live inside its cells. Mm. Now, just as, you know, our plants on land require sunlight to photosynthesize and make food, so do those algal cells that are living inside the corals. They need sunlight to photosynthesize. And so the coral that's hosting those algae needs to make sure that it is in the sun. It has enough sunlight to so those algae can photosynthesize.
So that's why coral reefs are always in relatively shallow areas.
That's right. In fact, the living part of the reef, of the tropical reefs, is usually up to about, between 60 and 100 feet. No, very few reefs you will find corals deeper than that.
So then there's another impact of global warming, of climate change that we worry about here on land, and that's sea level rise and encroaching seas. But then it doesn't seem like a deeper ocean should be a problem for ocean animals. But then what you're saying is essentially that if these reefs can't keep growing, they won't be able to keep up with sea level rise either. So sea level rise becomes another impact for corals.
That's right. In a healthy reef system, many reefs can produce calcium carbonate fast enough to keep up with slow sea level rise. But what's happening today is that with global warming and ocean acidification, and also the local stresses like the overfishing and the dynamiting and the nutrient runoff that exacerbates these global stresses, what's happening is that the rates of calcium carbonate production are declining, and the rates of erosion are increasing. And so the coral reef can't build up fast enough to keep up with sea level rise.
Now, there was just a study, you were one of the authors on a study that just came out in the past week, looking at specifically how nutrient pollution interacts with some of these climate impacts to, as you just said, shift that balance away from a growing reef to a reef that is increasingly being eroded away. So how does that interaction work? Do we know how that interaction works?
So what we found, and this was a study that was led by my graduate student, Thomas DiCarlo, at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. What we found was that bioerosion rates are very sensitive to changes in pH, in ocean pH. And that wasn't too much of a surprise, because in laboratory experiments, our fellow scientists have shown this to be true. So if we set up an aquarium with seawater with low pH levels, we find that bioerosion rates increase. And we show in this study, what we showed is this is true on real reefs out in the world as well. What was really surprising to us, though, was when you combine low pH, which is what ocean acidification is, with elevated nutrient concentrations, which comes from nutrient pollution and runoff from land, the bioerosion rates increase tenfold. So that means that you've got this interaction between a global scale stressor, which is ocean acidification, which is happening everywhere on all reefs, and a local stressor, nutrient pollution, combining to significantly escalate the rate of coral reef decline.
You mentioned this dichotomy between lab-based studies and being out in the ocean. Obviously, you can't put an entire coral reef, you can't put that whole ecosystem into a lab tank and, you know, do all these controlled experiments. How do you really start to get a handle on this when you can't necessarily do those sorts of controlled experiments where you have to go out and be looking around in the ocean? How do you start to tease apart these different factors and what's really at play?
That's an excellent question. So laboratory experiments are really, really valuable, and we have to do them because, as you alluded to, the ocean is really complicated. A living coral reef is a complicated environment with lots of things going on all at once, and it's very difficult to tease apart the relative contributions of different things to the decline. In a laboratory experiment, we can manipulate one variable at a time. So we can change the pH without changing anything else and see what that does. We can change the nutrient concentrations without changing anything else and see what that does to the corals or the bioeroding organisms. In this study, what was unique and different from what had been done before is that because of the scale of our approach, so we sampled about 17 coral reef systems across the Pacific Basin. And because of that scale, we were able to separate out the effects of pH from the effects of nutrients on bioerosion rates.
By some estimates, the ocean will be too acidic as early as 2050 to support much coral growth. We've already talked about the fact that 20% of corals have died because of warming temperatures and the fact that that's only going to continue. Are you thinking at this point that we are looking at the end of coral reefs? And if we are, what do we lose? Why does it matter if we don't have coral reefs? Is it just that we've lost something beautiful that we like to look at? Or is there a greater value to these ecosystems?
I think that was two questions. So the first, are we looking at the end of coral reefs by the middle of this century? Well, I certainly hope not. I am devastated by what's going on right now on coral reef systems and seeing firsthand the decline and the decimation of these incredible ecosystems. But at the same time, there's also a lot of goodwill. And especially in the island nations across the Pacific and also in the Caribbean, people and governments are really coming out and trying very hard to introduce measures to protect their coral reef ecosystems.
I have to say, though, Mark Patterson had essentially the same answer. I hope not. And that, at least for me, does not inspire a lot of confidence. It's not an I don't think so. It's not, I really think we have a chance. It's just, I hope so. Is it realistic?
What we absolutely have to do is control CO2 emissions. That's the bottom line. And my hope, again, is that internationally we are moving in that direction. In the meantime, what we can do on a local scale is remove or protect coral reefs against those direct threats, such as overfishing, dynamiting, sewage, other forms of pollution, and hope that the combination of those two measures moving in parallel will be enough to make sure that coral reefs survive at least the end of the century.
Why is that so important? Why is it so important that we have coral reefs?
I think in the U.S., maybe most of us associate coral reefs with fabulous vacation places. And they are. They're gorgeous. You know, if I chose to go anywhere on vacation, I want to go to a pristine, beautiful coral reef where I can dive amongst turtles and manta rays and whale sharks and see beautiful fish and thriving corals and all the color and the beauty that comes with it. But in fact, coral reefs are much more than that to many millions of people around the world. You know that 500 million people around the world are dependent on coral reefs for their survival. In Southeast Asia, with a population of 618 million people, 60% of the fish that feed those people come from coral reefs. In the U.S., the Florida Keys alone is worth $7.5 billion each year for tourism, for food, and for providing coastal protection from storms and tsunamis. $7.5 billion, just the Florida Keys.
That's Ann Cohen of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution with some inspiration to try to save our coral reefs. Ann Cohen, thank you.
Thank you very much, Heather.
I'm Heather Goldstone, more Living Lab after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the dramatic changes taking place in the ecosystems formerly known as Caribbean coral reefs. I say formerly because these days it might be more accurate to call them sponge reefs. Pollution, climate change, human activities all have taken their toll, devastating Caribbean corals over the past few decades. But in their wake, sponges have thrived. The thing is, we don't know a lot about how these newly abundant sponges function in the ecosystem. Liz Kujawinski and a postdoctoral researcher in her lab, Cara Fiore, would like to change that. Kujawinski is associate scientist with tenure in the Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and she joins me now about their crowd-funded sponge research project. Liz Kujawinski, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. Thrilled to be here.
Cara Fiore couldn't be here today. This is kind of her project that she's heading up. She's actually in the field. What is she down in Florida doing right now?
Well, she's actually trying to sample the water that comes out of sponges relative to the water that surrounds sponges. So she's diving to collect the water outside and inside sponges, and then she's going to bring it back to the lab, and we're going to analyze the chemistry, the chemicals that make up that water.
We're talking about sponges that can be as big as a small child. These are really big organisms in a lot of cases.
They are indeed. Yes, Cara Fiore did her PhD work on some of these sponges. And when she gave her talk introducing herself to my lab, I must admit that all of the chemists in the room, myself included, really couldn't get past the pictures that she was showing of herself next to these sponges, where full body lengths could be imagined inside them and so on. Yes, these are very, very large sponges. And the impact that they have on the ecosystem is really quite tremendous. And so we'd really like to understand a little bit more about that. And quite amazingly, we know very, very little.
Well, we do know that it's kind of like oysters, that these sponges pump an enormous amount of water through their bodies. It's something like 50,000 times their own volume every single day. What are they doing with all that water?
Well, we don't really know. The figures that Cara provided for me include something like sponges can overturn the water column of the Florida Keys, where it's about 10 feet deep. They can overturn that entire water column within about 2 to 6 days. So that means that they're filtering that water. We think that most of what they're filtering out are the little microorganisms that live there as a food source. But in addition to that, sponges themselves, at least many of them, contain very large microbial communities. So these bacteria and other organisms, they live inside the sponges as symbionts and compatriots, so to speak, feeding the sponge in other ways. We don't entirely understand what the relationship is between the water that comes in and those organisms that live there and the sponge itself, because we don't entirely understand what the difference is between the water that comes in versus the water that goes out. But certainly the idea is that the water that comes in is used to either feed the bacteria that are living there or the sponge itself.
Hmm. So a lot of your work in your lab and through your career has really been focused on microbes. Sponges are a little bit of a departure for you. Are you really interested in the sponges, or are you really more just interested in those microbes that are living inside them? I mean, are the sponges basically just a big water pump for the microbes?
At the moment, I think that our primary interest, certainly through Kara's work, is in the microbial community that lives within the sponges themselves. But really in relation to the workings of the sponge, the diversity of sponges that are present, which ones are in at reefs at different times, how they might be affecting coral health, sponge health, and so on. My lab has really been focused on the chemistry of water and how microbes affect that chemistry. And so what's really intriguing for me and what the crossover is between Kara's PhD work and the work she's doing in my lab is trying to relate some of our new chemical techniques to this question to be able to answer a little bit more in a little bit more sophisticated way what the chemical impact of sponges are on the water. So how do they affect water quality relative to the rest of the reef? Are they detoxifiers for the reef? Are they not? Are they somehow affecting the corals in a bad way? We don't know the answers to those questions. And I think chemistry is going to help us answer some of them.
Now, you said you're sampling the water inside and outside the sponges and looking for changes in the chemistry. But what kinds of chemicals are you actually looking for? I mean, is this just looking for nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, what's actually in the water? Or what kinds of chemicals are you looking for?
So the techniques in my lab are used to try and figure out which molecules of basically carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are in the water column. So very typically, when we think about water quality, we think about things like nitrate, phosphate, ammonia, some inorganic ions that are important for basic health. There are, however, small organic molecules that can have a very big impact on health of corals or sponges or really an ecosystem in general that occur in small concentrations and that need to be identified from a structural perspective. So things like glucose, so sugars, things like growth factors, hormones, and different compounds like that.
And those are just floating around in the water?
Indeed. Yes, that's correct. And we believe that microbial communities are able to interact with one another essentially by transferring substrates or molecules, food sources, from one to another. So one organism will take a molecule and convert it into something else that could be used or consumed by another organism. We don't understand how the microbial community that lives within sponges is acting in this way. And so we believe that there will be a chemical signature of that kind of activity in the water that comes out of the sponge relative to the water that went in.
So you'll be able to see what went in, what they absorbed, what
they
took up, and potentially any new things that they're adding back to the
water.
That's
right. That's right. The easiest thing for us to be able to tell will be the difference between what went in and what went out. We would love to be able, in our next phase of our project, to look at the community itself and see what's inside them.
You mentioned this idea that the microbes are essentially communicating with each other. How do they send those signals when they're so tiny, they're putting out chemicals into a vast volume of water? How does that not just completely get lost?
It's important to remember that bacteria don't sense the immense, vast environment around them, but instead that they are in a small space relative to one another. So even though you and I live in the state of Massachusetts, we're actually standing quite close to one another, and we can communicate that way. If you were talking in someplace in Western Mass and I was standing here and we were speaking at the same volume, there'd be no way to hear one another. But proximity plays a very big role. And so wherever you find bacterial communities in close proximity to one another, you can have communication occur. So you can have molecules that are transported outside the cellular membrane into the environment around them But because there's another bacterium close by, that bacterium, if they have the appropriate receptors, so in essence, you know, if they can understand that language, they can pick up that signal and then do their biology appropriately.
You've mentioned how little we know about what the microbes are that are inside the sponges, what they're doing to the water, what that means for what sponges are doing to the ecosystem at a whole, a huge range of questions. Do we have answers to those sorts of questions when it comes to the corals that are there? And we just haven't looked at the sponges because they haven't been as dominant before? Or is this completely open territory?
I think there's a lot of people who are beginning to look at these questions. Certainly colleagues of mine in the chemistry department at Woods Hole have been interested in some of these similar questions from the perspective of corals. So I believe that there are people beginning to answer and ask those types of questions. So it's not completely open. However, what I will say is that the application of these types of chemical techniques that we have in my lab, but also emerging across other labs across the country, they're bringing our ability to understand the chemistry to a different level. They're able, instead of techniques where we look for one molecule at a time, now we look for 5,000 molecules at a time. And that's just our discovery mode. If we want to really understand how much of any one molecule is there, we can look at 300 at a time. So a smaller number, but we get more information about how much is there and so on. So the new techniques that have emerged in different biomedical fields and so on that are being used to look at microbiomes and personalized medicine and so on, as we begin to apply those techniques to an equally complex environment like sponges or corals or the ocean in general, we're going to get a much more nuanced and much more sophisticated chemical picture of what's happening. And we hope, or certainly our goal, is to identify those molecules that are really driving the bus in terms of how organisms work together and what are the points of synergy in these unique environments.
How do you deal with data that is multiple samples, 5,000 chemicals, with the scale of what you're looking at in terms of the data you get back?
That's a really great question, Heather. It's certainly not what it was like when I was in grad school, where we had a couple of PCBs looking at a time and we could use an Excel spreadsheet.
Right. I mean, there's this wealth of data, right?
That's
exciting.
Right.
We can look at 5,000 chemicals instead of five, but then you...
That's right.
We have to look at 5,000 chemicals.
That's right. That's right. It makes your head hurt, I'm afraid. But we are very lucky in that new sophisticated bioinformatic tools are being developed that can help us mine these data sets in very interesting ways. We can think about mining them from a biological perspective. So, for example, we can ask a question, does this particular metabolic process happen? And if that metabolic process has been described in something like E. coli, a very common bacterial lab organism, then we can look at the predicted compounds that are predicted to be part of that process. And then we can look for those in our data sets, right? So instead of looking for 5,000, now we're looking for five targets. We can also use statistical tools to tell us that out of the 5,000, 500 of them are really important for this ecosystem. They go up when other things go up, or they are different in one set of sponges relative to another, or they are typical of the water coming out of the sponge, and they are not present in the water going into the sponge.
So there's a lot of other information that has to feed into that. You're not looking
right
at the chemical information in a vacuum.
That's right. That's right. And once we identify, well, I should say, once we figure out that there are 500 out of these 5,000 that are really critical for us to look for, then a lot of hard chemistry has to begin to identify the structures of those molecules. So how are the atoms bonded together? Because it turns out that the way the atoms are bonded together makes a fundamental difference as to how biology can interact with those molecules. And so we still have more work to do, but it's a huge step in the right direction.
You know, in biology, we think of the complexity. As we sequence genomes, trying to figure out what genes and proteins and what they do. But I'm sitting here listening to you thinking, just the space of possibility in chemistry is that much more enormous. To try to nail down the identity of a chemical and figure out what it does seems like an incredible mystery to try to tackle.
It is, but it's also an extremely exciting place to be. So this field is called metabolomics, and it's in the field of biomedicine already, and it's being used, as I've mentioned, in things like personalized medicine? Can we find molecules that indicate whether a person is healthy or ill? Is there a set of markers that are diagnostic of specific disease states prior to those disease states getting to a crisis mode? When I go to conferences about metabolomics, I'm blown away at the potential for the power of chemistry to help nail these questions for us.
Is that your goal? Would you like to be able to look at a water sample from a sponge or from the ocean and essentially, as you said, for humans, tell if it's healthy or not, whether it has a disease and what that disease might be?
I think in the grandest scheme of that's out there, I would love to be able to use our chemical tools to be the diagnostic for the oceans. As a scientist, I find that to be a bit of a hyperbolic statement. We never speak that way. So it's hard for me to describe it on that grand of a scale. But I think that that's exactly where we're trying to head. Are there molecules that can tell us that this particular ecosystem is in distress? Are there molecules that can tell us that this particular ecosystem is being taken over by an invasive species? Are there molecules that can tell us something about what kind of stress an ecosystem might be experiencing? Are they stressed due to temperature? Are they stressed due to anthropogenic pollution? All of these are important questions that I believe can be answered by letting the chemistry of the ocean tell us what's going on.
Let's go back to this smaller project that you're just getting started looking at water chemistry around sponges. And you've chosen to try to crowdfund this project as opposed to, say, writing a grant for it. Why?
Well, there's sort of two questions in there. One is, why didn't we write a grant for this? And the second is, you know, will the crowdfunding work? So our project is currently up on experiment.com with a end date of January 15th. And we have been asking for $3,000.
But $3,000 is not a lot of money, especially in the scheme of grant writing, where you're asking for tens or hundreds or of thousands of dollars or even millions of dollars usually.
That's right. That's right. As a general rule, though, getting smaller sums of money can be almost as difficult as getting large sums of money. There's kind of this happy medium. You want to ask for enough money when you're writing a grant that it justifies, you know, the amount of time that you've put into it, because, of course, you don't want to just put something out there that makes no sense to anybody, but at the same time can support the lab for an extended period. When you are writing a grant, you really have to show, particularly these days when resources are tight, you really need to show that what you think will happen has the potential of actually happening.
You almost have to know the end result before you do it.
You have to be pretty close, right? Or at least you have to show that the techniques are going to tell you something, right? I mean, what if the water on the inside and on the outside of the sponge is exactly the same?
Well, what if they're exactly the same? Doesn't that still tell you something?
That does tell you a lot, but it's going to be hard to get a grant funded with that little information, right? So what we need, the reason we decided to crowdfund this was because we thought this was a great project. It lent itself nicely to crowdfunding. Sponges are interesting. Coral reefs are really compelling and important ecosystem-wise. And the importance of this work feels like it could be conveyed more easily to our educated public rather than some of the more esoteric stuff that I work on. It's not a lot of money, but if you look at the crowdfunding statistics, you can't raise a lot of money with crowdfunding. So we'll see if it works.
Well, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
Dr. Liz Kujawinski is associate scientist with tenure in the Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She and postdoctoral researcher Cara Fiore are crowdfunding to support their research onto the chemical ecology of Caribbean sponges. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.